this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles the composer Steve Mackey. Susan Lewis takes us to Van Gogh Up Close, a major exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And we speak with Sir Stephen Whaley-Cohen, producer of the world's longest-running play, The Mousetrap. A new production of the Agatha Christie classic is at Philadelphia's Walnut Street Theatre. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Princeton-based composer Steve Mackey has often been heard in Philadelphia in pieces written for Dolce Swano Ensemble and the Network for New Music. Now this rocker-turned-cutting-edge composer is unveiling a work written for the traditional instrumentation of the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. He also has a Grammy nomination for Best New Classical Composition this year and future commissions from the likes of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns met him at Princeton University, where Mackey, as chair of the music department, has no plans to put away his electric guitar.
Classical composers and performers sometimes look enviously at their pop music counterparts. They say, "Get me out of this penguin suit. Give me an arena, a cheering crowd, a mosh pit." Not Steve Mackey. His rock and roll habit was cured decades ago at a bar in a ski resort.
This club called the Bear Pen, and they had these dormitories above the club where the band would stay for a week. And it's just a dive, right? I mean, gum stuck to the walls, and, you know, you play until 2 a.m., and then you drink some more, and, you know, you go to bed at 4, belly full of cheap pizza, and then you'd wake up at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and your day would be gone. That life didn't really appeal to me. And the gig itself, you know, we wanted to play originals, my spacey, too hard to dance to originals. So they'd take one or two in a row, but then they wanted the Doobie Brothers or something like that. They'd dance to the Doobie Brothers, and then when, you know, the originals came on, they couldn't really dance, and they just start talking.
The experimental rock he grew up with in Northern California in the late 1960s was dying. Then he realized that classical music took him on the journey that he was looking for, a journey that, for him, ultimately led to a PhD at Brandeis University and top-of-the-line compositional chops. Not that the classical world was particularly welcoming at first, when Mackey paired electric guitar and string quartet. But at least with a bit of patience and a tenured faculty position at Princeton, a composer can wait out resistance. Even if the public was a bit mauled by the 1960s avant-garde, the classical world has a history of extremely heterogeneous music. Gustav Mahler, for example.
I felt like that was the most ambitious music. Classical music has kept itself alive by broadening its gene pool. Sacred music and Turkish military marches and learned counterpoint and Austrian folk songs, and we call that classical music. And the whole reason I got into classical music was like rock music seemed too genre-based. It's a pretty narrow band out of which, if you step out, it's no longer rock music. You listen to the history of classical music, you go, whoa, it's all over there. That's what I should be doing. Classical music is the biggest home. It's the mother of all musics.
Mackey's newest CD, the Grammy-nominated Lonely Motel, is all over the place, even by his standards. At one point, Mackey paraphrased a segment of the old TV show The Twilight Zone.
Think of the gambler in the Twilight Zone episode who, after dying suddenly, finds himself in the plush suite of a casino with money in his pocket and beautiful women on his arm.
More invasive is his collaborator, the performance artist Rindy Eckert, with his penetrating tenor voice, freewheeling poetry, and fearless sense of social criticism. Even closer to rock are some of the pieces he does with his band, Big Farm, which plays all of 2 gigs a year because the members are so busy with more highbrow activities.
We're not 25-year-old kids that are willing to, you know, go on tour in a van, but we would really love to play more. As the bass player put it, said, Big Farm is the only band that I play with where we rehearse for a week for one gig for no money. We all do it and lose money on it because we love it and we think there's something there.
Much of what Steve Mackey draws from popular music is internal or conceptual, not so much how the individual components of the music act, but how they interact. This is how he explicates the classic Neil Young song, Helpless.
The words to that song are not self-standing poetry, but just this whiny falsetto and singing the words helpless. You don't really know what it's about, but with those chords and that whine and that tessitura, it melts into one. I mean, it's a marriage of interdependency, not a great poem and great music. It's this, you know, the words are the music and the music is the words.
That sense of interdependence has led Mackey toward more consolidated music, the most obvious instance being his new Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia piece, Tonic. The title refers to a kind of seizure suffered recently by his 3-year-old son. It's hardly a conventional genesis for an orchestral work, but composition is an elusive process. Sometimes you don't know what you're drawing on until well after the fact.
The older I get, thankfully, the less choice I have. That's what's going on. And like I say, I didn't set out, I'm going to write a piece about this range of the meanings of tonic. You know, really was this kind of abstract, simple, mad scientist. What if I took these chords? But then you react to the sound. And then the piece, you know, was born around that.
From its inception, the new piece stood to give Mackey a more decisive place in the landscape of orchestral composition. Even the most traditional living composers tend to occupy the concerto slot on the first half of the program, and Mackey knows it well. This time, he'll be on the program's second half. That is truly classical music primetime.
I've written a lot of concertos in the last decade, and which I love doing, and I've got a feel for that, which I don't think all composers do. But I was thinking that, you know, I've been listening a lot to, like, Sibelius symphonies, for example, and just thinking, man, I'd like the opportunity to do something without having to think about making the soloist look good.
The Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia's chief executive, Peter Gistelink, knows what a chance he's taking. He's doing it anyway.
I recall when I started here in the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, I saw that several times there were modern contemporary pieces incorporated in a classical program, and I kind of felt like, you know, do they try to hide it or something? I said, if you do it right, and give it its own space.
This could be a recipe for self-indulgence, but if nothing else, Tonic is among the most clearly wrought pieces of Mackey's career, and whether or not it rocks or makes classical audiences happy, the piece represents an incredibly healthy process for modern music. While ivory tower composers became so caught up in the process of composition that their personalities tended to get lost, Mackey's musical voice is inescapable, though constantly morphing according to what his pieces are trying to say. His music is about something real. No wonder he's foregoing the glamour of Sunday night's Grammy Award ceremony in Los Angeles, where he could well win in the Best New Classical Composition category, to be at the premiere of his newest piece in Philadelphia.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia performs Steve Mackey's Tonic in concerts tomorrow afternoon and on Monday evening at the Kimmel Center's Permanent Theater, and on Tuesday evening at the Temple Performing Arts Center at Temple University's main campus.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Celebrated as one of the world's great masters, Vincent van Gogh lived a life as intense and dramatic as his art. Despite struggling with mental illness in the last years of his life, Van Gogh produced 800 paintings and 1,200 drawings in a brief career that started late, at age 27, and ended early with his death 10 years later. An exhibition now at the Philadelphia Museum of Art makes the case that paintings from his last years show that this talented and tortured artist was more deliberate than rash when it came to his art, and even more innovative than previously believed. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers Van Gogh up close.
His American public calls him Van Gogh. Elsewhere,
in Dutch, I say Vincent van Gogh.
Connie Homburg is co-curator of the current Philadelphia Van Gogh exhibition.
And in French, I say Vincent van Gogh. It depends. I think every language has their own pronunciation, and that's perfectly fine. He's such an international artist by now that I think we can all use our way of pronouncing it.
Many think of Van Gogh as a talented artist who cut off his ear and made swirly paintings of the night sky. This stereotype misses the truth of the real man, says Leo Jensen, curator of paintings at the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, which has published the artist's letters.
He is known as a madman who made beautiful paintings, but did whatever came up into his head. And his letters show that he was a very systematically thinking and working man. He had a program for himself, and he always had a goal that he was striving for.
His letters to his brother Theo chronicle Vincent's thoughts about many of his paintings. They're also the source for titles of many works, which he himself left unnamed.
He simply considered every painting an attempt to grasp something of his craft.
The exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art begins with two sunflower paintings. In one, brilliant yellow flowers stand tall in a vase, their petals bold brushstrokes against a turquoise wall. Just to the right hangs another image, this one with a deep blue background, on which lie two large flower heads seen close up, their withered petals created with gold and red paint layered and lined thick on the canvas. Joe Rischel, the museum's curator of European painting before 1900, says these two paintings highlight the direction in which Van Gogh moved.
The first one's pretty radical in itself, but the drama, the light, the speed of the painting, the sort of emotional charge of the picture. The other one takes it a notch further.
The idea of a close-up look at nature fascinated Van Gogh in his last years, says Jenny Thompson, the museum's associate curator of European painting.
He's really playing around with the picture plane and the sense of depth in the painting. So there's a very great sense of flatness to them. There's a moth in the show that literally looks as if it's been squished between books and you're actually seeing just the outline of it with this great sense of detail. The two sunflower heads in the exhibition, which are larger than a person's head, and make things very large in the front of the pictures, and then the background will kind of either become blurry or nondescript. So there's a real sense of something that is coming into focus right in the front of the picture, and then the rest of the picture you start to lose a sense of space or a sense of location.
So something that we may associate with close-up photography of the early 20th century, this is actually Van Gogh who, in his paintings, tried that out in the late 1880s.
Co-curator Connie Homburg says while we 21st century viewers are now accustomed to this kind of composition,
this very radical way of zooming in on a detail of nature was something that didn't really happen extensively until after Van Gogh had died. But in the 1880s, you have, for example, Degas, who makes nudes, compositions, which he crops very dramatically, has very dramatic angles. But Van Gogh really brought the outside world into focus in this way. At the same time, while he was really unique in the way he did this, he was incredibly knowledgeable about older art. He loved Japanese prints, but he also loved old masters.
Born in 1853 in the Netherlands, it would have been natural, says Joe Rischel, for Van Gogh to go into the family business.
Because he had three close kin who were art dealers.
And so he trained for that, living in London, The Hague, and Brussels.
And not only did they sell contemporary art, they sold imitations, they sold reproductions of older things. His job was to inventory and make files of these. It meant from his late, early teens, he had this repertory of visual images.
Van Gogh was also well-read and spoke and wrote in four languages. After getting out of the family business and failing at an attempt to become a minister, Van Gogh, at the age of 27, turned his intense drive to creating art.
And he just worked and worked and worked to learn how to draw and to learn how to represent the world around him.
After painting and drawing in the Netherlands and Belgium, in the tradition of Rembrandt and the masters of Northern Europe, in 1886, filled with ambition, Van Gogh headed to the cultural hotbed of Paris. He appeared on the doorstep of his younger brother Theo, who was an art dealer, and showed him his first major work, The Potato Eaters.
This famous picture, poor people having their modest meal, and you know what, it was brown and black. And Theo had to say, we're not doing that anymore, you know.
Theo was working with the Impressionists, who were using vibrant colors in a style that was totally new to Van Gogh, says co-curator Jenny Thompson.
He really, for the first 5 years of his career, had never seen an Impressionist picture. He was sort of working in isolation. And then he comes to Paris, and he's shocked by what he sees there, and sort of quietly works away on these flower paintings for quite a while. But it's amazing how quickly he gets up to speed.
Becoming friends with people like Toulouse-Lautrec, Pissarro, and Gauguin, Van Gogh stayed in Paris for 2 years, painting portraits, still lifes, street scenes, gardens, and landscapes. He drew on his increasing visual repertoire, which included images from Japanese woodblock prints, of which he collected hundreds. In February 1888, he moved to Arles in the south of France to take advantage of the light and to continue to develop in his own style. This show includes paintings that put the viewer right next to him.
You'll see a gallery called Blades of Grass, where he's looking right down at what's underneath his feet, which are literally blades of grass, clumps of iris plants, this real sort of myopic focus on literally the ground.
Other works show his awareness of the vista, as in his Field with Flowers near Arles, which he wrote about in his letters, says Connie Homburg.
And he said, I was standing there amidst these yellow and blue flowers, and he was talking about these irises. And then this meadow with maybe buttercups or something like that. And then the skyline of Arles far in the background. And this is where he was talking about what is close by and what is far away. And you really have the feeling that you're standing right next to the artist, among these irises, so to speak, looking into them.
Another work puts us in the middle of a forest, among bold tree trunks whose leafy tops are unseen beyond the top of the canvas.
You have these rows of trees which are cut off on the top so that they become, as he actually called it himself, like columns walking across the landscape. And how does he call this painting? Undergrowth. So it's not about the trees even, but it's about looking down. And as he often did in paintings, he added a pair of lovers in there, which was sort of a romantic streak of his.
His Field on Wheat Sticks is so abstract, it looks as if it was done in the 20th century. His poppy field layers on pinks and reds, making one think of tapestry. And in another work, sheaves of wheat appear almost like dancers on a ballroom floor. In Arles, he began suffering with hallucinations and seizures, variously attributed to alcohol, epilepsy, or the chemicals in his paints. In December of 88, he famously cut off a small piece of his ear after an argument. He committed himself to a mental hospital in Saint-Rémy, where he continued to paint, but only when he was able. He painted the delicate almond blossom as a gift for his nephew, also named Vincent, who was born on January 31st, 1890.
He paints this picture, and 2 days later he falls ill, and he is ill for 6 weeks and can't work at all. And he writes afterwards to his brother, "It is such a tragedy, these bouts of illness that I have, because you should have seen me paint the almond blossoms. I was so in control, and I was so deliberate."
In May of that year, Van Gogh left the clinic to move to Auvers, north of Paris. On July 27th, he died of a gunshot wound, believed by most historians to be self-inflicted. Yet so much of his last work was celebratory and optimistic.
I mean, the pictures sometimes, they're like Beethoven's Ninth, you know, they really just take off and knock the heavens to bits. I mean, they're just joyous sort of exaltations and mystical and really true visionary things.
Vincent van Gogh may have been many of the things we know him for, a prolific and passionate man who lived a short but driven life, tormented by demons at the end. But despite his illness, he became a master of art and changed the way we, in turn, might look at our world, close up and far away. From golden apples on a kitchen counter to the glory of a starry night, to buttercups, irises, and sunflowers sprouting wild from the earth beneath our feet.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Van Gogh Up Close is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through May 6th. 60 years ago, the world was, in many respects, very different from today. In 1952, America was fighting the Korean War. The ocean liner, the SS United States, now mothballed in Philadelphia, made her maiden transatlantic crossing, and the United Nations was just beginning work on its headquarters in New York City. Dwight Eisenhower was elected to succeed Harry Truman as President of the United States, Winston Churchill was Prime Minister of England, and King George VI, he of the King's Speech, died. The King was succeeded by his eldest daughter Elizabeth, who this year will celebrate her Diamond Jubilee. Also in 1952, in London's West End, an Agatha Christie play called The Mousetrap began what is now also a 60-year and counting run. The play is regularly produced around the world. The Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia is now presenting its own production. It's been commonly believed that Agatha Christie herself insisted on restrictions as to when, where and how the play should be performed. But producer Sir Stephen Whaley Cohen, who purchased the play 18 years ago from the original producer Peter Saunders, says that's not the case.
This is one of the fictions created by commentators. The arrangements that Agatha Christie insisted on were simply that no film be shown till after the end of the West End run. She never specified, as I have read 100 times in the last 6 months, that there be only one production outside the West End.
Interesting.
She didn't control that at all. Her producer, Peter Saunders, who put on all her plays, and from whom I acquired The Mousetrap when he wanted to retire, he said, I don't mind where it is outside Britain, but I don't want it on in my main prospective tourist markets. I don't want it on in Australia or South Africa or New York. But he didn't mind where else in the world it was or where else in the US and Canada it was.
It's just a coincidence that this play was written for the present Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth's grandmother, and it also opened the year of her coronation.
Well, 60 years is quite extraordinary. Many things have changed. The producer has changed. I always say I'm rather new. I've only been there, it's nearly 18 years now, and that seems silly to a lot of people for whom 18 years is a very long time.
Tell me the circumstances under which you inherited it and what your aspirations were for it 18 years ago.
Well, I wish it was inherit. I'm afraid it was purchase. I inherited a responsibility for this theatrical legend. I bought it because it was a very good business proposition. I bought it because it made me instantly part of theatrical history. What did I change? I changed two things in the first months. One of the characters, and this here, Agatha Christie was well ahead of her time. There is a young man who is clearly gay, but it had become played as really a screaming queen. And it got a lot of laughs, but they were cheap laughs, and it spoilt the plot. And so I said rather nervously to the very long-time general manager, a very experienced man, but who himself was very discreetly gay, do you think there's any basis for that? And he said, no, I'd love to change it. So I said, good, let's change it straight away. Let's make him discreetly gay. We know he's gay. Let's not make him
an object of
an
ridicule.
Object of ridicule and derision and squealing and floppy wrists and all those caricatures.
And the second thing?
And the second thing was really derived from the fact that Peter Saunders had become old and everyone was frightened of him. The chief electrician in the theatre said to me rather nervously, because of course I hardly knew him and he hardly knew me, did you know that you can't see the heads of the people when they enter at the back of the stage if you're sitting in the last few rows of the upper circle? So I said, no, I didn't know that. He said, because the set, being an old-fashioned set, which we've changed since then, but not immediately, has a ceiling on it, like any room has a ceiling, and it's too low. So I said, well, can we lift it? He said, yes, but it will be expensive. So I said, how expensive? He said, I think it might be nearly £500, which he was frightened to ask Peter Saunders about. So I said, how quickly can you do it? Let's do it. So those were the two things I changed in the first few weeks, really. Since then, we've changed some other things. We did have an entirely new set, the first entirely new set, about 12 years ago, but it's a replica of the first original set. We also returned the play to its late 1940s, early 1950s timescale. For reasons that I think I understand, during the 1970s and 1980s, some of the references that clearly referred to 30 years before had been removed. So the mention of ration books, which we still had in England in the late 1940s after the war, a reference by one of the characters to haven't seen snow like this since 1940, they were all changed to something that was timeless. And we decided to put it very firmly back in its original about 1950 timescale. And we try and do that with the costumes as well as the words.
When you thought about having this show be performed outside of London, outside of the United Kingdom, how much control then do you maintain over all these different productions, if any?
Very little control. We insist that they use the text. If they want to change the words, they should ask. They don't always, but they should ask.
And the format, are you dictating what the era is, what the setting is?
No, we're not dictating it. We offer guidance because we don't see why people around the world should necessarily know what costumes were in 1950s England. So we now do send people who want to do it some guidance on costumes. They can see from the original play script what the original set was. There's a photograph of it there, and we're happy to share more information on that with anybody who asks for it. But if somebody wanted to do it in steel and concrete and glass, not that they built buildings like that then, and you have to remember it is set in a manor house inherited in England in the 1950s, and one of the characters says it is probably an old monastery. That kind of dictates the sort of set that it needs.
Final question. We started off this conversation by talking about the fact that Agatha Christie decreed that a film should be made of it only after it had finished its run in the West End, 6 months after that. Can a film be made and shown elsewhere?
Not anywhere in the world, no. No. The film rights are controlled by some combination of Matthew Pritchard, her grandson, and our company, and we're not about to authorise anybody to make a film.
How long can this thing go on for?
I've said before, and I said at the time of the 50th anniversary, and I'm happy to say now that I really don't see why it shouldn't run forever.
Stephen Whaley-Cohn, worldwide producer of The Mousetrap. The Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia's production of the play runs through March 4th. And that's our programme for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.